Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and I don't have to tell you that in this country, politics are intensely polarized right now, and journalism is an endangered species. So what about in the UK? We have a nice opportunity right now to meet the editor of The Guardian newspaper of Britain, Alan Rusbridger, who happens to be in New York today. The Guardian is a liberal paper in the British journalistic tradition under which the press's leanings are disclosed more overtly than here, although the United States is now heading in that direction on cable and online. The Guardian claims the second largest readership of any English language newspaper behind the New York Times. Alan, so nice of you to come visit us here at WNYC. Welcome.
Very happy to be here.
The U.S. has an election this year, national election. The U.K. has a national election this year. Are politics as polarized between left and right there as here?
I sense it's not quite as wild as it sometimes seems here. It's becoming more polarized. I think the financial crisis, whereas a year ago there wasn't much to choose between the two parties in terms of financial policy, I think the closer they get to election and the tougher the choices, you are seeing clear blue water between two ideas of the size of the state and how much to tax, how much to spend, and all those issues that you've had over here.
So similar to here, in a way, that's what the Tea Party kind of sprung up over. Big government, government debt, the bailouts and the stimulus and response to the financial crisis.
All that, though I think at the heart of it there is a greater attachment to what the state can do. So the things like the health service, which I know was a very controversial issue here, is a kind of act of faith in Britain. So you're not going to get political parties tampering with the health service or really tampering with the universal access to free education. There is a big debate at the moment about the levels of taxation that can support that and things like efficiencies.
How does the UK see America's healthcare debate? I realize there's no average Briton, like there's no average American, but as closely as you could tell it, are most people laughing at us or sneering at us? Does it break down along Labour and Tory lines, how they see the debate that's taking place here?
Complete incomprehension, I think. We find it, this phrase, socialized medicine, which I know is supposed to scare people off, is regarded as a right. I mean, people feel incredibly strongly that this is something that was introduced in 1945. It isn't perfect, but it is inconceivable that any politician would want to do away with it. So we just can't understand the fear and loathing and hatred that it engenders.
How about the rationing under the health service? Here, insurance companies say no. There, if you're in the health system, and I realize some people get private care, does the government say yes or no?
Well, there are debates about certain kinds of medicines that are very expensive or too experimental or whose benefits have not yet been proven. But there are not the British papers are not full every day of stories about rationing. It's a very expensive service to run. It costs a lot in taxes. But if you had any poll of the British people, they would overwhelmingly support it.
My guest is the editor of The Guardian newspaper of Britain. Am I saying your name right? Alan Rusbridger?
You've got it right.
Great. And we can take some phone calls for him. I don't want to make this about health care in the United States, folks. We've been talking about that endlessly forever. But let's compare some things in politics and journalism, and we will talk about journalism in this conversation too, between the U.S. and U.K. or anything you want to ask the editor of The Guardian. Maybe you read The Guardian, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You talked about increasing polarization along the question of the size of government. Debt, of course, is an issue with Greece imploding and the possibility that bigger countries in Europe like Spain may not be far behind. The rest of the Eurozone is agonizing over how much to bail them out. Britain is not in the Euro system. Does The Guardian, as a liberal voice, have a rooting interest in how that turns out?
Well, I think we're broadly in favor of Europe and as a countervailing balance to the states, and we're broadly what you might call a Keynesian follower of Keynesian economics. So we thought that the fiscal rescue was a good thing, whether enough money has trickled down into businesses as opposed to getting stuck in the banking system is a moot point. But I think there are great dangers in slashing taxation and trying to shrink the size of the state at the moment. I think the fiscal rescue is not robust enough yet. And I think there are dangers that by taking measures that would increase unemployment, you could have dangerous social instability of the sort that you're getting in other countries in Europe.
Well, many Americans look at the European welfare states, and the Americans say, now that is unsustainable. The population is aging faster in Europe, meaning more retirees per taxpaying worker. Economic growth is more sluggish, almost by design. Unemployment is higher. And the benefits everyone gets are more generous. Aren't those debt chickens going to come home to roost big time and burst Europe's social democratic bubble eventually?
Well, I don't think there's one European social model. So Scandinavia, it works just fine. Go to a country like Norway, it is incredibly stable. They've really got their finances worked out. Germany has a much more long-term view. They've still got industry and localized systems of banking and finance that aren't so short-term. I think one of the problems the UK is in trouble was that we became too dependent on the financial services industry. And that, I think, is more the problem than necessarily the burden of spending on the state.
I see that big in your paper today are the election campaign manifestos from the Labour and Conservative parties, the equivalent of our Democratic Republican parties. The Conservative manifesto under candidate David Cameron suggests California-style voter referenda on issues if the advocates of an issue can get just 5% support to start out, then it gets on the ballot. Are they suggesting national referenda on everything from tax rates to abortion rights?
I think it's not terribly worked out yet. I think it's a powerful populist idea, and I think the Conservatives have some interesting ideas about devolution and trying to return power away from the center. But I think this idea of referenda probably is one of those things that crops up in manifestos as a semi-worked-out idea but needs to be fleshed out.
You, of course, have question time, the rough-and-tumble questioning of the Prime Minister by other members of Parliament. It was such a big deal here in the U.S. when President Obama recently took questions from Republican lawmakers, and now there is a demand question time movement. I don't know if you've heard of that, springing up among some advocates of open government here. What purpose does question time serve, in your opinion?
Well, the worst bit of it is that it's very yaboo, lots of noise, shouting, point scoring. I think there is a benefit in getting the Prime Minister to appear once a week in front of elected representatives and holding him or her to account. And if you speak to Prime Ministers about it, they don't like it, but they say it really, you know, once a week you have to be absolutely on top of your brief, on top of all the facts, and be prepared to defend it in front of 600 MPs, half of whom are going to be very hostile. So I think it's a sort of a weekly democratic reality check, which is quite useful.
Do you think it serves to polarize Britons against one another, or perhaps to vent polarization and not let it take as deep root in the people? Or is it irrelevant to that?
I think it's probably relevant to that. I mean, there is something about the House of Commons which is, I think lots of people find a turnoff because of it. It's polarized atmosphere, and it feels like a 19th century institution. So I think there are reforms that are necessary there. But I would have thought it would, in the context of the states, if you could find something that wasn't nakedly partisan and aggressive as in Britain, it would have some purpose.
So you also have ranters like this, British representative to the European Parliament, Nigel Farage, is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Addressing the president of the European Parliament to his face in a kind of question time on meth.
You have the charisma of a damp rag and the appearance of a low-grade bank clerk. And the question that I want to ask, that we're all going to ask, is who are you? I'd never heard of you. Nobody in Europe had ever heard of you. I would like to ask you, President, who voted for you?
So how emblematic is he of the level of discourse over there?
Well, he, I suppose he would be the nearest thing to the Tea Party in the UK. And he speaks for an anti-European populist style of politics, which has a constituency, but it's a tiny splinter in terms of mainstream politics. It's a tiny splinter act, and because of the two-party nature of the British politics, it's never going to be more than that.
Eric in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Alan Rusbridger, editor of the Nation, editor of the Guardian.
I wish.
Or the Nation, maybe the Nation wishes it was the Guardian. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have to tell you, I just love listening to your show.
Thank you.
My question for your guest is, I've read about, and I even saw some televised debates for the upcoming election and in the UK, and I wondered if he thought this was a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not a big fan of presidential debates in the U.S. because they often seem to just be just so oddly constructed as to being useless. But I'd like to get your guest's take on that.
Are they different over there?
Well, we've never had them before, so we'll find out soon. And all we've had so far is the debate of the chancellors. I have mixed feelings. I mean, I think on balance, I'm in favor of it because I think they are long, that they're an hour each, and I think it's the opportunity to see the prime ministerial candidates being tested. My reservation is that we don't have a presidential system, and so I think it focuses all the attention on the party leaders, and I have some reservations about going down the presidential route, and rather prefer the parliamentary route, where the prime minister is the head of MPs in Parliament. So I think it accentuates a trend which I don't feel entirely comfortable about.
Eric, thank you for your call. Alan, did you hear our previous segment before you were on?
I didn't. I'm afraid
it was about a proposal that's considered relatively fringe here in New York for a temporary tax on large Wall Street bonuses to help New York State bridge its budget gap over the next 2 years. And I see that the mayor of London, Boris Johnson, claims that around 9,000 bankers may leave that city following a tax on bonuses of over £25,000 and a 50% tax rate for top earners. He accused someone named Alistair Darling in a letter of fast-tracking the departure of this talent pool out of Britain. That's exactly the debate that we're having in New York right now, and we had just before you got on the air. Is this tax, in fact, imposed in London?
Yes, and they always say that. They're all you always have these scare stories of bankers threatening to leave. And if you ever ring them up a year later or two years later, surprise, surprise, they're still there.
They don't leave, really? Wouldn't they move out to the countryside?
You occasionally get one or two very weird ones. So there are some people who actually leave their family behind in London and commute, but you can count them on the fingers of one hand. I mean, the truth is London is a great financial center. It's important to be there. And that's why people stay. You always get these ritualistic noises saying we'll go off to Guernsey or we'll go and rebase in Ireland or in some other low-tax regime, and they never do.
Alan Rusbridger, editor-in-chief of The Guardian, the British newspaper. Did I overstate your claim to circulation before I said you list yourselves as the second most widely read English-language newspaper behind the New York Times? Is that accurate, or is it just online?
No, that is online, yes.
That's online.
I mean, you might have to qualify it and say serious. I mean, there are one or two gossip sites and gossip papers, but in terms of people who are doing serious news, that's true.
Henry in Cobble Hill, you're on WNYC. Hi, Henry.
Hey, how you doing, Brian? How you doing, Alan? I read your paper online quite often, mostly the soccer section, the football section, and I'm a little concerned. I guess it's more of a question. Do you plan on charging for your online content at some point? Are you going to follow in the footsteps of Murdoch and seemingly everyone else and charge for online access?
You are prescient, by the way, Henry, because that is perhaps the main thing that Alan is in the United States to talk about right now. He addressed a conference of newspaper editors in this country yesterday, and this really was topic number one, right?
Yes, I think there's a great anxiety that I have, and I know a lot of journalists have, that this period of experimentation that's going on at the web about being open and being collaborative, which I think is enriching to journalism and is allowing lots of people to take part in our journalism, is going to be prematurely brought to an end if we all rush to put paywalls around our content. So we're not planning that route. We'll watch to see what Murdoch does. I suspect it's not going to work. But I think journalistically it's better, and it's better for readers if we can keep our content open for as long as possible.
It's interesting to me that you're against charging people to get content online, because I've been told that newspapers in Europe in general are not in the same kind of crisis as in the United States, partly because less of your revenue comes from advertising, that more of it comes directly from readers buying the papers. And in fact, the hard copies are a little more expensive than here to make that model work. Is that basically true?
That's true. The balance between cover price and advertising revenue is more balanced than it has been in the States, though I think that's changing in the States. But the advertising crisis and the shift to the internet through the technologies that are there, and the possibilities that the internet gives everyone to be a publisher. So these are very severe forces that are bearing down on us. And I think the answer is not to try and fight that tide, but to go with it. So there are lots of examples now on The Guardian where we are working with the readers in what I like to think of as a mutualized way. To create better journalism rather than trying to throw up a big wall around our content and saying you can't even get at it unless you pay first.
What we call crowdsourcing projects, that kind of thing, where you enlist the readers as additional eyes and ears?
It's partly crowdsourcing. It's partly recognizing there's another new media mantra, which is our readers know more than we do. And that is often true. And it takes a bit of humility from journalists to acknowledge that. But a moment you acknowledge that, that takes you into much richer territory.
But in terms of you criticizing newspapers that want to pay for web content, want to make readers pay for web content as a business model, as a means of survival, many of them would see it. The Guardian's a nonprofit institution, existence guaranteed by a family foundation, isn't it?
Yes, I'm not criticizing others, and I'm not lecturing others, and we have a very unusual model, which, as you say, is a trust, which was set up in the 1930s just to promote the kind of journalism that we do. And it has companies behind us. So I think all that does is to give us the possibility of a longer-term framework. It doesn't insulate us from the crisis that's facing everyone else. But I think it enables us just to say, well, hold on a minute, let's just think about what's right journalistically, because that might take you in a different direction from a perfectly understandable stampede to try and get money in now.
You're identified as a liberal paper. Others in the UK are identified as more conservative. In the US, as you know, we tend to divide it up more, at least in theory, by news pages and editorial pages. Newspapers are supposed to be objective here. Whether you have a liberal editorial page like the New York Times or a conservative one like Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, it doesn't always hold, but that is still the theory and the ideal in most American news organizations. How do you approach the question of objectivity at The Guardian if your whole paper comes from more of a point of view?
Well, it's kind of the reverse of the American situation in Britain. So if you're a broadcaster, you have to be objective and impartial, which I understand not to be the case, to put it mildly, here. But newspapers for 300 years have always had a polemical basis. I don't hold with objectivity. I think it probably doesn't exist. But
you wouldn't say that you're in the business as editor-in-chief of The Guardian of just putting out spin for your point of view, right?
No, I mean, the dictum, comment is free, but facts are sacred, was actually a Guardian editor said that in 1921.
So how is that different from the American model of objectivity?
Well, we go for we aim for a separation of fact and comment. I think we start from a point of view that all editorial choices are to some extent subjective, and we don't have separate editors. So I edit the comment pages and I edit the news, and I don't see that as a conflict, but it is very different from the American model.
So last thing, do you think it's good that the U.S. media is polarizing more? The Fox versus MSNBC model now, I don't know how much of that you've seen, but cable news channels arranged by very sharp ideology. Do you think that's a good thing because it pulls the veil off their posturing? Or is it a caricature and a cheapening of what journalism or news talk are supposed to be as you see it?
I find it, to my taste, it's unattractive. And it raises all kinds of queries about who pays for these channels and the control they have. I think one of the glories of Britain is the BBC, which is by statute impartial. It's the only really business model that currently works. It's license funded. It's a brilliant news organization. It's a pain to compete with if you're a newspaper because it has a brilliant website. But I wouldn't like to live in a Britain that didn't have that kind of model.
Well, we have networks here that strive for objectivity as well, in addition to these. Are you saying it's more distasteful for you if it happens in broadcast than if it happens in print?
Well, what I see of the most polarized aspects of American TV, I just don't like. I think it's ugly. I don't think it aids understanding to a great extent.
Do you have it in the UK?
You
don't have a British Sean Hannity or a British Keith Olbermann?
No. All broadcasting is regulated and is required. So you've got this, I think, quite...
Required to stay within
certain... Required to be impartial. They have requirements about what they can and can't broadcast. They have to fulfill a certain amount of cultural broadcasting, religious broadcasting, and so on and so forth. And that may be old-fashioned, that kind of paternalistic regulation. But I think that, hand-in-hand with a newspaper system that is more attached and polemical, is quite a good mix.
Alan Rusbridger, Editor-in-Chief of The Guardian. Great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll talk to the New York State Health Commissioner, Dr. Richard Daines, about St. Vincent's Hospital next. Stay with us.